It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. How are we, humans that is, changing our planet? For the good, for the worse. Nicole Heller wants to know. She's the world's first curator of the Anthropocene at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, and she joins us now. Nicole Heller, welcome to the confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
All right. So before we get to your work, to your research, what you're trying to find out, help me clear up the things first, please. Anthropocene derives from the Greek meaning recent age of man. That's I got that?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. And epoch comes from Latin meaning a division of time. So what is the Anthropocene epoch?
Yeah. Yes. So the Anthropocene is this newly proposed geological epoch, like you said, following the Holocene. And the idea here is that human beings have become such a dominant force in the entire Earth system that we've basically moved out of the conditions of the Holocene period of time. We're in a new period of geological time. So that's how geologists look at the whole history of the Earth. And they use fossils and layers of geology, basically, right, to tell the story of the history of Earth. And the Anthropocene is this current time we moved into when humans are leaving a mark throughout that geology due to our activities. And I should say the Earth system might not be familiar. I mean, basically, that's a descriptor of all of the components of the Earth, from the atmosphere, the climate and the air, the water, the hydrosphere, all the water, the oceans and the lakes, together with the terrasphere or the biosphere, all the plants and animals living on land, and then with the geosphere. So that's the Earth system. And humans are restructuring all of the processes and interconnections of that entire system for the first time that we know.
So just like maybe the glacier age impacted the Earth, the human
exactly
a wave, if you would, has impacted the Earth.
Right. And so we have to think about humans and our activities in understanding everything that's going on the Earth today and in thinking about what the future is going to look like.
So impacting how? Give us an example.
Yeah. So I think the most maybe well-known example that's talked about is climate change through our burning of fossil fuels and other ways we're changing the climate, and the entire Earth's climate is changing and very rapidly. We are acidifying the rivers, the oceans, the trees. Acid rain is something people might have heard about. That's from pollution as well. Then extinction. Many, many animals and plants are going extinct. Some scientists think this is the beginning of the sixth great extinction on planet Earth, and that's due to humans driving these species extinct. I could go on and on. And one of the things about the Anthropocene is it's the first time that we've collected all of these different kinds of changes under one umbrella and tried to think of it as one collective phenomenon.
Right. You are not a segregationist, though, and that's my term. You're not advocating a separation of humans from nature to limit our negative impact.
That's right. This is something I feel very strongly about, and I think, you know, a lot of scientists or concerned people do is kind of this question of, well, what do we do in the face of this? Do we try to kind of remove ourselves even more from nature, or do we turn toward nature and think about our interconnections with other organisms and how we can kind of reintegrate our relationship? How can we rethink our relationship to nature and reintegrate ourselves into it in hopes that we could find a more sustainable path so that as we're developing human society, we're not doing that at the expense of all of the other creatures on planet Earth. They're not doing it at the expense of our water and our air and so on.
So how did you get involved? I mean, were you interested in anthropology and geology? Were you interested in environmental science? How did you get involved in this?
Well, I mean, my beginnings are actually just like most of all the other curators at the Museum of Natural History. I'm an ecologist. I studied basically the behavior and ecology of other animals my whole life. I've always really been interested in ecology. And so I have a PhD in ecological sciences. And ecologists have really been at the forefront of this movement. We in ecology, this idea has been called global change. So I've often called myself a global change ecologist. And my background is understanding how ecosystems are changing in response to anthropogenic changes or human-driven changes, and then how we can mitigate that so that other species can survive better, so that wild systems can continue to be diverse and evolve on their own trajectories.
So what were your research here in Pittsburgh focus on?
So I'm just getting started really with my research here in Pittsburgh. I have been working for the last 10 years in research in California on land management practices. So, or how we kind of how we do conservation work. And as basically my story is, I started as a traditional conservation biologist working on or ecologist, and then really started to seeing the impacts of things like climate change or invasive species or all these habitat alterations. I realized that we couldn't kind of do conservation as normal, because what was happening, conservation was built on this premise that sort of if we protected nature in protected areas and parks, then it would be safe forever. But if you think about climate change, even if we put a fence around a wild area and say this is an area just for plants and animals to stay here forever, they won't stay there forever because the climate is changing. And so these impacts are happening. And so I really realized doing my research, we can't think of ecosystems as separate from human life. And so this caused me to really start to think about this integrated lens. How do we make changes in our cities and where we do agriculture and where we do forestry so that we think about that as integrated with biodiversity at large, with the natural system? And so my work in California has been about doing this kind of integrated, holistic conservation across the landscape. And here in Pittsburgh, just beginning to understand the ecological issues here, but I'm very interested in working on things like green infrastructure. You might have heard that idea,
right,
which
is
how do we bring more nature into our cities in order to better protect ourselves from things like heavy rain events? And the question I'm really interested in is how do we do that so that it improves biodiversity as well?
Right. All right. Admitting our role in air pollution, water pollution, whatever, the bad things, we've got to have done something right. Have we done anything positive as a species?
Wow, that's a big question. Yes, we've done many things positive as a species. I mean, of course, it depends on from whose perspective,
yeah.
Right? And always when you ask this question. And I think without a doubt, all these technological changes that are associated with bad outcomes for the Anthropocene are also were driven by, you know, innovation and have made many people a lot wealthier, have at large, lifted the quality of life of many human beings. And so I don't think the answer is to this problem is to turn away from all of that. It's really thinking about what are the things we're doing that are benefiting humans, but how could we kind of make them also benefit other species as well? How could we make them more compatible with a healthier ecosystem that we live in? And so I'm not sure I quite answered your question.
Well, you're trying to give a little praise. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question, and I'm really an optimist. I really believe that we can continue on the trajectory, but do it with a lot less impact, and be, you know, I think a lot about a tree. Actually, I read a great book this summer called Overstory by Richard Powers, and that talks about trees are this being that make themselves out of nothing, out of air and sunlight, and then they make their bodies provide food and fiber and nuts and all kinds of things for other creatures. So I wonder, as humans, could we become more like a tree? Could we grow ourselves and be generative of all kinds of other life?
All right. We have just less than 2 minutes left. Briefly, you're excited about this, obviously. Carnegie Museum of Natural History is excited about it. Why should Pittsburghers be excited about this?
Well, Pittsburgh is such a relevant place to the Anthropocene, right? I mean, this is a great industrial city of the world. And Pittsburgh is in the process of remaking itself and in a new economy and a new times to be as sustainable and a thriving as place as possible. And so I think the Carnegie's engagement with the Anthropocene is really a part of that remaking, a place for the community come together and think about what they want this city to look like. What do they want the world to look like? And that's pretty relevant.
And you've got a couple of events coming up for folks who want to learn more.
Yes. So there's an event later this September, on September 26th. It's called Environmental Institutions Representing Nature in the Anthropocene. So that's going to be a dialogue with journalists.
Including Reid Fraser from
WESA. Fraser, right, and myself, and a English professor, Heather Hauser. And with the Pitt Humanities Center is sponsoring that. That's free. And then a second one on October 25th, talking about a book that I have a chapter in with a colleague from anthropology called Future Remains, A Cabinet of Curiosities for the Anthropocene. So both of those are free, open to the public conversations about this topic and with the museum.
Well, Nicole Heller, thanks so much for being here. She is the world's first curator of the Anthropocene, and she's at Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris, still ahead on The Confluence. The online streaming service Hulu has a new series about a human mission to Mars set in the 2030s. But how do producers predict the technological ups and downs between now and then? That's coming up on Marketplace Tech. A pending lawsuit could force Pennsylvania to change the way we fund our schools. And a new public source reporting project wants to know, is there a more equitable way to pay for quality education? And we'll get an update on the investigation into the gas pipeline explosion in Beaver County this week. Why did a recently completed line rupture? That's coming up when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Don't you just hate it when things backfire? One night, after watching Chris Isaak's drummer talk to women at the bar, Adam Duritz of the Counting Crows wrote a song about how much better his life would be if he were just famous. Mr. Jones became a hit, and Duritz became more famous than he could have dreamed of at the time. Though in recent years, he's grown to resent the song, sometimes not even playing it in concert. August and Everything After was released 25 years ago this week. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new play inspired by a classic painting takes audiences into the back rooms and passages of a landmark downtown Pittsburgh church. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports on the world premiere of Quantum Theater's Chatterton.
Even if you've never seen the painting The Death of Chatterton, you know it. It's an iconic romantic image. A beautiful young man, pale as marble, with a head full of bright red curls. He's committed suicide, but the scene is far from grisly. He lies draped peacefully on a bed, bathed in the soft light of dawn, and one cold fist clutches scraps of paper, presumably his unsold writings.
Even though he wrote in another voice, a creation, a character, he was clearly a great poet at a terribly young age.
That's Carla Boos, artistic director of Quantum Theater, talking about Thomas Chatterton. The impoverished British poet committed suicide in 1770 at age 17 and posthumously became a hero to romantic artists. The painting, though, dates from 1856, nearly 90 years after the suicide it depicts. The artwork inspired Peter Ackroyd's acclaimed 1988 novel titled Chatterton. Now Boos has adapted that novel into a play.
It's all about forgery and theft of intellectual property and what is real and what isn't in the art world, in the literary world, and in reality.
Boos says the play asks, what if Chatterton didn't really die? The story takes place all in London, but in three different centuries.
The higher the winds do blow.
That's Jonathan Visser in rehearsal. He's the tall, red-headed actor who plays Chatterton. The poet wrote in the voice of a medieval monk, a figure whom Chatterton invented but passed off as real. Martin Giles plays the 19th century artist who painted Chatterton's suicide, using as his model the famed poet George Meredith.
You will be immortalized!
The play's 20th century characters include Harriet Scrope, an aging novelist who is investigating Chatterton's supposed suicide, but who also might have misrepresented her own writing. Scrope is played by Helena Ruati.
I've given my life to English literature!
But while Chatterton is about fakery, Trinity Episcopal Cathedral is the real thing. The English Gothic building with its 200-foot spire was built in 1872. Inside, the sanctuary is cavernous, with high vaulted ceilings and acres of stained glass. Chatterton is an immersive work, so rather than sitting still all together in one place, the audience will split up to follow a dozen characters for scenes set deep in the cathedral's interior. And even up and down staircases.
It's just perfect to take people up there where they would not normally get to go.
The cathedral sits right on 6th Avenue. Its churchyard is populated by likely the city's oldest tombstones.
This is where people will begin their evening with a glass of cider and some instruction.
Bruce and Quantum's team took a dozen spaces in the cathedral and made them over with set dressing and projected video. Actor Martin Giles, who also helped Bruce with the script, says it's fun for actors to play all the different rooms.
Because some of them are big and some of them are small. Sometimes your voice echoes, like the sanctuary is fantastic. You know, it's like an actor's dream. And then sometimes you're playing in this really intimate little room.
The grandest space, of course, is that sanctuary where Chatterton is our guide.
And so you see how I came to be a great lover of antiquity.
Other chambers became an art gallery, an antique shop, and a couple of living rooms. But one room might be especially memorable for audiences, says Boos.
In this room, the audience gathers at the end of Act One for a scene that takes place in an Indian restaurant. And it's kind of cool because it's going to transition to the place where they have their dinner.
Yes, Chatterton is dinner and a show all in one, with a full meal catered by a different local chef each week. And afterward, the audience can digest Act Two and some more provocative ideas about authenticity in art and life. Chatterton opens Friday and runs through October 28th. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
Chatterton is part of the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust's Festival of Firsts. WESA receives funding from Quantum Theater. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto reopened the investigation into the sale of a city-owned home and promised to work closely with City Controller Michael Lamb on a review of the treasurer sale process regarding tax-delinquent properties. What triggered this? Well, at least in part, the reporting of Rich Lord of the Post-Gazette about the city real estate manager purchasing a Beachview house for the back taxes, $2,500. Rich Lord, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
So, Rich, you reported this all started with Aaron Pickett, real estate manager for the city of Pittsburgh, a city employee, as the seller on behalf of the city and the buyer?
That's right. Mr. Pickett runs the real estate department in the city, around 20 employees under him. And one of the functions of that department is to take properties that had been tax delinquent and had been taken by the city and try to sell them. And we uncovered in June a case in which he took one of those properties in Beachview and sold it, and the buyer he found was himself. And he signed court papers on behalf of both the city and the buyer, Aaron Pickett.
And that's legal?
According to the city initially, yes. The city launched an internal investigation after we reported this, and the initial finding was that there was no bar on a city employee selling themselves a piece of city property. And the city's argument then was that no one else had emerged to buy this house, so you know, why shouldn't they sell it to Mr. Pickett, get it back on the tax rolls? What we subsequently found was that at least three other people had put in applications to buy the same house.
So legal, according to the city, but ethics?
Mr. Peduto, the mayor, has said that there should not have been ethical questions, that certainly this raised ethical questions and referred it back to the city's internal investigators, the Office of Municipal Investigations, after we found the three other buyers. Of course, the question is why they didn't find the three other buyers without the Post-Gazette having to do it for them.
Doesn't City Council have to approve the sale of city property? If so, how'd this get overlooked?
Yeah, roughly every 3 months, the city council receives a list of properties that the city is trying to sell to private individuals. And typically, city council members will look at them and will see whether there are any properties there which might be coveted by their neighborhood groups or may become part of a bigger development someday. And then council members will occasionally block a sale. But it's pretty rare that they block a sale. And in this case, no questions were raised regarding Mr. Pickett's purchase.
The deed's already been signed, but could the transaction be reversed?
I don't think so. Reviewing the law, I think there are times in the process in which a transaction can be reversed. But it basically, the party has to emerge and say, hey, we had an interest in this property, but we weren't properly notified. Then they can seek to have a sale voided. But those time limits have long passed in the case of this Beachview property.
You mentioned three other possible or at least interested buyers. So the city could have actually lost out on some money?
One of them told us that he would have paid $40,000 or perhaps more for this property, but the city only got $2,500 for it.
In addition to whatever policy changes might result from this, could there be any repercussions for Aaron Pickett? I mean, what he did was legal.
I have no idea. We added that new fact to the city's investigation that there were alternate bidders. I think what would occur from here would depend on whether Mr. Pickett or anyone else in his office knew of the alternate bidders and whether any action was taken to subvert their efforts to purchase the property.
Rich Lord is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, Rich.
Hey, thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A lawsuit pending in Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court has the potential to change the way the state funds schools. Six school districts are suing the Pennsylvania Department of Education, the governor's office, and other state officials to throw out the current school funding system. Is there a more equitable way? And is a lawsuit the way to get there? I'm joined by education reporter Mary Niederberger, who's exploring this issue with a new series, Failing Our Future, for Public Source. Welcome, Mary. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the lawsuit, Mary, how are Pennsylvania schools funded now, and what's wrong with that system?
Well, the way Pennsylvania schools are funded now works very well in communities where they're able to raise local wealth. The local real estate levy funds schools. People may complain about paying their taxes, right, but it does fund schools.
So property value leads to revenues for the school districts.
Yes, and high property values means good schools. But the problem exists in communities where there is not property value. And generally, a lot of what we see are the former mill towns. The steel mills left, then all the other industries left, everything that supported the community left, and there is no local tax base. And so no matter how high those officials would try to raise taxes, they can't come up with enough to support the school system.
But I want to not so much to get buried in the numbers, but a couple years ago, changes were made to direct more state monies to poorer districts, but that formula only applied to additional monies above the previous education budget. Do we know yet if that's having any impact?
Very little, because it's such a small amount. Yeah, it
hasn't
had any
major. So part of a $6 billion budget, right, if it's an extra $300 million, sounds like a lot, but in percentage terms?
Correct. It hasn't. You can talk to people in Stowe Rocks and Wilkinsburg and places like that. It hasn't made any major effect.
Okay. Now, if the plaintiffs are successful in this lawsuit I alluded to, it could force the state legislature to create a new funding formula. Lots of states have these, a set dollar amount for every student with multipliers for different learning needs, et cetera. Is that what we would get in Pennsylvania?
Well, to be very clear about it, the Education Law Center is, and that's one of the major plaintiffs, along with the Public Interest Law Center, they aren't asking for any specific formula. What they want, first and foremost, they want more money toward education. And then they want a formula that supposedly would not rely so much on these local taxes, because as long as it relies on local real estate revenue, we'll have the inequities. So it's very open-ended. What they essentially want, if they win this case, would be for the court to order the legislature to adequately and equitably fund education.
They're telling them how to do that adequately and equitably?
Yeah, that those are the two. They want adequate funding, and then they want it distributed equitably. But they don't put amounts. They have said that their studies have shown it would cost another $3 to $4 billion to adequately fund education. What the lawsuit doesn't say is it doesn't specifically say where that money would come from, though it makes references to new revenue sources. And then they want the money distributed more equitably so that we can diminish these large disparities between the districts.
Your series, Failing Our Future, that you've done for Public Source, focus on a handful of school districts, especially Stowe Rocks. What about their story is central to this debate?
What about their story? The biggest thing about their story is they live in the shadow of a wealthy district. And they know what the students up the hill have and what they don't have. And it's not about, this whole series is not about that the wealthy district shouldn't have what they have. It's about bringing more to the really poor districts and the wide disparity between what you see from 3 miles up the hill to down in Stowe Rocks.
Give us a sense of how that inequity sort of manifests itself, whether it's in teachers, equipment, resources.
It's across the board. The teachers will tell you that over the last couple years, they've had maybe 10 to 12 teachers leave who weren't replaced. And so what that means at the high school level, in order to offer any kind of electives for the students, each teacher has to teach multiple classes. They don't really have a lot of planning periods. There was a math teacher who had to prepare for 5 different math schedules so that the kids could have those kind of electives. And even still with that, their course offerings are very, very narrow. There's no air conditioning in the school. It's a really old building. It's sweltering on hot days. The kids don't have much access to computers. They do have some netbooks on carts that they can use. They have a librarian, but she has to teach classes, so she isn't in the library, so they don't have a librarian.
Yeah. One Stowe Rocks parent told you, quote, "I get embarrassed. It just reminds me of the failure that I am for my kids." That would seem so painful to have to say that.
I think it was very painful for him to say it. He was with his daughter at a regional music concert at Mount Lebanon High School. And Mount Lebanon High School in recent years has undergone, I think, $110 million renovation. And it's a wonderful school. It offers great things to its students. But to know what your child has in Stowe Rocks and to be standing in this just marvelous facility in Mount Lebanon, those were his feelings. That's how he felt.
You mentioned Stowe Rocks and its proximity to another school district, but do the kids, the students in Stowe Rocks, I mean, how are they responding? Do they even notice the inequities? Do they know what other kids, even nearby, are getting or have that they don't?
They do. And the saddest part about it is they shrug their shoulders and say, it's just where we live. We can't have it. They're just totally resigned to the fact that they know there's not a lot of wealth in their community, and they're not going to have the things that the other kids have. But they absolutely know, especially the kids who are on teams and who are in the band, who travel to other facilities, they know.
Oh, so they see, I mean, whether it's the facilities themselves or individually assigned equipment, Chromebooks or something like that?
Or even band instruments, or band uniforms. Right. Yes, yes.
So, Mary, you got more stories on the way. What else do we have to look forward to?
Well, what we have to look forward to is a piece I have coming up on how teachers in these districts do a lot of things to bring supplies into the classroom, whether it's taking advantage of online fundraising, whether it's going to the Education Partnership, and also spending money out of their own pocket just to give the kids the supplies that the districts can't afford. And there's also going to be a story on general disparities across the county with a chart that looks at exactly how much real estate revenue can be raised in each school district so that you can understand why local funding for schools creates these huge disparities.
You could say education funding or disparity in education funding is a social equity, a social justice issue. But it's also a budget issue, too. They've got to come up with the money somewhere and somehow and then distribute it.
Correct. We're also, though, going to look at what are some things that can be done before, if there is ever a big, huge overhaul, what could be done before that? Because even if the court case is successful, you're looking down years before you would see changes. So could there be sharing of resources? Could there be wealthier districts helping poor districts in some ways? We found some little examples of that. For instance, Hopewell allows Aliquippa students to take AP classes at their school. Could there be more examples of that? So we're going to try to explore what are things that can be done beyond the massive effort of coming up with a new revenue source and a new funding formula.
Mary Niederberger is a reporter for Public Source focusing on inequity in education. You can find her latest series, Failing Our Future, on school funding, pa.publicsource.org. Mary, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, an explosion along a recently completed natural gas pipeline in Beaver County destroyed one home and forced the evacuations of others. Emergency responders and residents want to know why that line exploded, what the company plans to do to build back their trust. We're going to get the latest from reporter Reed Frazier from the Allegheny Front. Reed joins us in studio now. Welcome, Reed.
Hi, Kevin.
So before we get to the why, Reed, you spoke with some people in the neighborhood. Let's have a listen.
Like I said, I've been around for 44 years. I've never experienced anything like that. I likely won't again. You guys will be fine. And the gas is off right now, so there's no gas running through it. So it's not going to catch fire again.
I mean, my initial thought was a jet airplane crash. Then I heard a hissing going. And that's when it all hit us, what was happening. You know, right away you knew the pipeline went.
The gas line explosion is what first thing came to my mind, and because I know where the gas line runs and the location of my neighbor's house, and the wind was pushing towards his house, and man, it was ugly. It was darn ugly.
All right, Reed, was there shock, surprise, anger? Oh, well, did they even know the pipeline was active yet?
Yeah, I think that caught a lot of people by surprise. That I don't think they knew that it was that it had gas in it yet, but they were certainly aware that this pipeline was going in behind their homes. It had been a construction project the last few years, some of it going through their own property. So there was a lot of those emotions. I mean, I think the main emotion that a lot of the residents are feeling is just mainly shock right now.
The company that owns the line, Energy Transfer Partners, shut down a portion of the pipeline after the explosion. Are there early indications of a cause?
Well, yes. The officials suspect a landslide brought on by the rainfall over the weekend from the remnants of the Hurricane Gordon, which dumped about 5 inches of rain in that particular part mm-hmm. of the state. Was the cause. Now, this is a brand new pipeline. So up until a few, you know, days before this happened, there had been people, crews working on the pipeline right away to like put the grading back and the dirt back. So we're not sure what condition that right of way had been when this rainstorm struck. And that's going to be a question going forward.
So, you know, we've been talking about landslides all year, landslides affecting homes, landslides affecting roadways, collapse of roadways. And now a landslide might have forced a pipeline bursting.
Yeah. And, the landslides are going to be a fact of life in the Pittsburgh area more and more because of climate change, because these storms, while they may not be more frequent, they have more water in the system. There's more heat in the oceans. And these, I was around in 2004 when Hurricane Ivan came right through Pittsburgh. A lot of people will remember sort of devastated areas like Millville and Etna.
The Chartiers Creek area.
Correct. So that is basically the same amount of rain that fell over the weekend. These pipeline right-of-ways are built to withstand a 100-year storm. If this is happening every, 15, 20 years, I think we need to redefine maybe what a 100-year storm is.
Okay, so you reported that recently, you reported that the recently completed pipeline had already experienced some rain-related problems during construction months earlier. Was that in the same area of the explosion, though?
No, that was a few miles off. That was in a part of Beaver County where the pipeline came close to Raccoon Creek. And the, you know, there was a bunch of soil that got into the creek, and you know, there's state laws. That's a violation of the State Clean Streams Act. So they got fined $145,000 by the DEP. But this was in a different part of the pipeline route, and as far as we know, there were no violations on this particular area.
Right. So shifting landslide could have ruptured the line. But do we know what sparked the gas to explode and erupt into flames that shot up, we're told, 150 feet?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we don't know, or at least, you know, the investigators haven't said what they think is the cause of the initial spark. But, you know, we can only speculate. I mean, I will tell you that this line was sort of in the woods on a very steep grade. Not an area where there's, you would anticipate, you know, a lot of human presence, especially 5 a.m. on a rainy Monday morning. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're only left to speculate.
Because you just described where this pipeline was, first of all, is the gas used locally? Is it shipped out of state? Are these homes that are nearby, whether it was destroyed or evacuated, are they sort of being made vulnerable for a product that they'll never use, actually?
Well, that's a good question. It's kind of a philosophical question, but I will tell you that this was a 24-inch gathering line, and what that means is that there's a bunch of gas wells in Butler County where they're pumping the gas out of the ground. They send that gas to a compressor station, and then from there, it goes through this 24-inch gathering line, and it's basically more or less raw gas. It's got all the constituents of what comes out of the ground, and it they send it to basically a gas refinery in Washington County, and from there it becomes the kind of gas that you use in your home or in factories, and it can be shipped elsewhere.
All right. So, just in our remaining minute, Pennsylvania Utilities Commission is investigating. Who's in charge of investigating the line itself, though, or inspecting the line?
Yeah, I mean, that'll be, you know, that'll be a combination of the company and the state regulators. You know, there are probably going to be many tests of the line before it goes back into service. Yeah, this type of line, a transmission, not a quote unquote gathering line, is sort of the purview under the jurisdiction of the Pennsylvania Public Utilities Commission.
Okay. Very briefly, any other investigations possible by other entities?
You know, I'm sure that other agencies are going to be very interested in what happened here, possibly the DEP. You know, there is a federal agency within the Department of Transportation that does look at pipelines, so they may be involved at some point. Who knows?
In just a few seconds, any indication when we might have some answers, even to what sparked it or when things can move forward?
Not really. You know, just for reference, there was a bad explosion in Westmoreland County in 2016. We still haven't gotten the full report from that back yet, so could be a while.
All right. Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front. Thanks so much, Reed.
Thank you.
For today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, his work, his caring, his understanding has comforted and inspired 3 generations of children. He revolutionized children's television programming. We'll visit with the author of the first full biography of Fred Rogers. And we're going to talk to the authors of a study that looked at the sustainability of Pittsburgh's local music scene. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.